Welcome to the Sound of Economics, the Bruegel podcast. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and today I bring to you a podcast live that is live recorded at an event we are doing together with partners in Norway, U3D, on the Future of Europe conference. This conference is very much looked at across the European Parliament, the Council, the Commission. It is a conference that was supposed to bring together the citizens of Europe to voice their views and concerns about the future of Europe and potentially even lead to a completely differently functioning European Union. This process was started some time ago. COVID-19 pandemic has interrupted the process, but now it is re-emerging and restarting that discussion. Yesterday, on Wednesday, the 24th of June, the Council of the European Union published its opinion, its view on how the process, how the conference of on the future of Europe should be organized. And if you look at the Council opinion, you see very clearly that the Council does not have big ambitions. It would like this conference to be a series of events across EU member states that then leads to a report that will be delivered to the European Council, so in other words, to the heads of states and government in the EU. The Council also says clearly that it does not want this process to lead to any treaty changes. So it is not a convention. It is not the idea of this Future of Europe conference is not, according to the Council, to create a completely differently functioning EU and to lead to have treaty change according to Article 48. So welcome to our event today on redefining Europe's role after the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a very, very big issue and a very broad topic, obviously, but it comes at a very, very interesting moment, not only a moment in which gradually European countries end their lockdown measures and escape from toughest part of the pandemic. Perhaps we will have other tough parts, but anyway, I mean, we are improving the situation at the moment still. But it comes really at a moment where a lot of minds start to think now about the so-called Conference on the Future of Europe. And this Conference on the Future of Europe was supposed to be a pivotal moment where citizens would bring their input into what they expect from the EU and lead to changes of the way the EU operates and Europe in general operates. That was the big hope. The whole discussion was very much delayed and has now taken new urgency as the Council of the European Union published yesterday a paper on the Future of Europe conference to give its guidance on the future of Europe. What the Council wants to see from this conference is really a series of conferences where all institutions are involved, but also citizens to bring their input and shape the discussion on the future of Europe, which would then lead to a report in 22 that would be delivered to the European Council. So in other words, to the heads of state and government of the EU. This report, this will certainly raise some controversies and the scope, as the Council sees it, of this conference of on the future of Europe will be limited in the sense that it will not cover treaty changes, it will not cover Article 48 of the EU treaties, which allows for ordinary legislative treaty changes or simplified treaty changes. With me today here to discuss these issues and what it also means for differentiation
in the European Union. So for different countries, different levels of integration, are really three renowned experts and deeply involved politicians in the whole matter. Let me first welcome Gabriele Bischoff. She's a member of the European Parliament and the vice chair of the Committee on the Constitutional Affairs, AFCO, and a member of the Working Group on the Future of Europe Conference. Welcome, Gabi. Let me also welcome Calypso Nicolaidis. She's a professor of international relations at the University of Oxford, and of course, a well-known scholar of European integration. And last but not least, let me welcome John Erik Fossum, who is a professor at ARENA at the University of Oslo, and who is a partner on a project that Bruegel is engaged with, which is called EU3D, which is really a project about differentiation, democracy, and dominance in the European Union. It's a Horizon 2020 funded EU project, and we are co-organizing this event really with EU3D, so with John Erik Fossum, who's leading this project. Thank you again all for joining. Let me perhaps before giving the floor to Gabi also say that we very much look forward to questions and remarks from the audience. The audience can give their input on Slido. Please go on the website sli.do and type in EU3D. Then you will be able to ask your questions. And in the second part of our conversation, I will actually ask some of the questions to our panelists. So without much further ado, again, welcome to all of you. Welcome to our listeners. It's a real honor and pleasure to host this conversation on the future of Europe today, what it means for the constitutional setup, what it means for citizens, but also what it means for countries that are outside of the EU, perhaps such as Norway. I think we will have a great conversation. And let me start with Gabi Bischoff. Gabi, you are in the working group in the European Parliament looking at the Future of Europe conference. And I think many in the European Parliament have had really very high expectations of this Future of Europe conference. The Council seems to put a sort of brake on this, on the ambitions of this Future of Europe conference by saying, well, in the end, we don't want any treaty change and we want only a report to the European Council, which then the European Council will consider in its wisdom. But, you know, basically the result is a report. The end result is a report. Am I too harsh with my assessment of the Council, and what will the European Parliament do?
First of all, I think it's very timely that we have the debate today, and finally, after 6 months of talking, discussing, negotiating, the Council agreed on a mandate. So we have now the mandate of the European Parliament with, as you said, an ambitious program for this conference on the future of Europe. And on the other hand, we already have the mandate of the Commission, which was also very timely in January. And now we have the third mandate of the Council mandate. And from now on, negotiations will start between the three institutions on the governance, the organization, and further on of this conference. So what the Council agreed on yesterday, after a long time, is not what it will be, but it's what the Council wants. And we will see how the concept will be after the negotiation. But I think it's quite obvious that we have some differences regarding the governance. But I think, as you said, a key point is that the plan of the European Parliament, and it agreed with broad majority of all political groups, is really to have one conference that lasts for 2 years and that has different layers. But these layers are all part of this conference. So you would have an institutional level, you would have citizens' agoras on different issues, and you would have the youth agora, and it all together would form the conference. And what at the moment, if you look at the mandate of the council, is they want different events. They want that these events will be in the end summarized by a report. So it's a bit of repetition what we already had 2-3 years ago. Remember with the proposal of Juncker and the scenarios, the debates that took place, and this beautiful report that the European Council drafted and debated, and nothing coming out of it. And I think this will be a key point in the end, where will be, on what will the three institutions agree in the end? Will it be a meaningful exercise or not? And I always quote it, I'm not surprised about this last paragraph on Article 48 in the council mandate, because they always had this kind of surrealist approach, you know, this Magritte picture, Ceci, ce n'est pas une pipe. This is not a convention. We have to sort of write it down. And it was never intended to be a convention, but an open process. But then the important things will be what will follow afterwards and what will be the next step. And if you have an open process and you involve a lot of citizens, civil society, academics, you embark on a process and you will see in the end how much appetite there is also with citizens on treaty changes and on certain changes. And I think the COVID pandemic you referred to shows us sort of in a almost painful way where some deficits are and where we have to improve.
But Gabi, can I push you a bit more? Because I think everything we said so far is very abstract, right? I mean, for a citizen to understand what we are talking about, I think it's actually very difficult, right? I mean, so first of all, I mean, why is this topic about changes of the treaties or changes of the way the EU functions on the agenda in the first place? I mean, you mentioned the pandemic now. Is it that the pandemic has taught us major deficiencies in the way our institutions operate? I mean, what really is the issue here? Is it democracy? Is it legitimacy? I mean, can you just give us a bit more of a sense of why the European Parliament thinks so much that there need to be big changes? And then afterwards, we can perhaps unpack a bit what would be the convention and what would be the way to change treaties if that is necessary. But first, why do we want to see these changes?
I can give you some examples. In the view of the European Parliament, a key objective is to have a European Union that is capable to act. And if you look in the last years, we can see, for example, if you look at migration and asylum policies, that the citizens in Europe realize that Europe is not capable to act properly together here. It's very divided. The council is blocked since years. And we are seeing a tragedy developing in the Mediterranean, and nothing is changing. Or the experience in the pandemia is that the immediate reaction was a sort of national impulse to close the borders, to not let medical products reach other European countries within a common market we have, and that you cannot address a pandemia only on national level. I think that was very obvious to citizens. And when they realized that Europe has almost no competences to address this, many people were surprised about this. And to see we will have to face more situations like this. And therefore, I think the crisis, the pandemic again made it obvious that in certain areas where Europe is not able with the 27 to agree anymore on a common policy, that we need certain changes here. And let me just stress to go back that you, for me, Europe is so often a Europe of missed chances. I mean, we had this debate on fighting pandemias in the last convention. We also had proposals how to change it, but we were not able to do so. So I would look at this from a very practical perspective. What are expectations? This will be part of the debates. What are expectations of citizens? What to address? And in which areas they think changes are necessary? What kind of changes? And to feed this into the institutional debate.
So in a sense, if citizens want to see change with regards to competences on dealing with pandemics and health crises as the way we saw them, that would be a moment where they could voice it, and then the European Council could consider it and perhaps even decide that, after all, it may be necessary to do some treaty changes so as to give some competences to the EU level to deal with the pandemic, with future pandemics, more effectively. So let me turn to Calypso. Calypso, you've been researching, and you're also part of the EU 3D research network, which looks at differentiation. And of course, health is one interesting dimension where we have complete differentiation in the sense that it's all national competences, very little EU competences. But then we also have other areas where there is really differentiation between Euro countries, non-Euro countries. There's the countries outside of the EU that are still closely integrated with us. How do you see those aspects of differentiation to be reflected in the Future of Europe conferences?
Guntram, absolutely. I think that this moment demonstrates that the lessons of COVID need to be reflected not just in the minutiae of the conference, but the ethos. Gabby, not a pipe, yes, but a pipe dream, I would say. And I think the pandemic really lays bare the great relevance of our 3D, not just because we all yearn to see each other in 3D and not just in 2D one day, but because, you know, I take our slogan in our network to be no differentiation with domination and without democracy. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you know, what does it mean in terms of just slogans for the conference, for the vision we want to develop? So can I give you three types of differentiation, Guntram, to build on what you just said, and each have their operative word. The first is differentiation as experimentation. After all, the COVID-19 pedagogies that we are really facing as societies, you know, this long-term process of collective effort as individuals and collectives to keep experimenting, learning from our mistakes, adjusting. And what is the EU, if not a mega experiment in polycentric governance, you know, in modern history? So for me, the right lesson here is not just that, hey, we need more Europe here, more Europe there, but that we have Europe organizes multiple scales and locus of governance. That is, we have actually different autonomies, different circles of autonomy. That's the operative word. Starting from household, neighborhoods, regions, you know, even in France, the Girondins who support regional-centric approach are winning over the Jacobin Paris-centered. Wow. But of course, we see this all over the world. So if we ask about, you know, Gabby's capacity to act, I think we really need to distinguish between two different types of role for the EU. One is really as a connector between these different circles of autonomy that can be the nation state, and we need to take the sting out of sovereignty. It's right and proper that our states, you know, with different capacities, vulnerabilities, exercising different modes of coercion, react differently. But here the EU comes in as, hey, good old open method of cooperation, mutual learning, synergies. That's different from an EU role as, I would say, not connector, but integrator. You know, we're back in a big way to the old chestnut of strategic autonomy for the EU. And that's, again, you know, something on different fronts that we need to think through. A big thing about COVID is the public versus private, that states need to reassert, they are reasserting their power internally, taking over the economy in big ways, but sometimes they need to do it together to, you know, to procure, whether it's PPE or, you know, vis-a-vis Apple and Google tracing app. Why are we not together on this? But there is another front. The second front is not public-private, but of course it's some version of geostrategic autonomy. Are we in a new Cold War? Do we have to really, can we be autonomous, not from the US versus China, but from their own zero-sum logic? You know, and that's where foreign investment screening and all our discussions about multilateralism, you know, come in, and we'll talk about this. But very quickly, Guntram, and that's one type of lesson. But this is differentiation as experimentation and autonomy. But differentiation as hierarchy is, you know, one of the big bugbears that we had when we created this 3D network. This is what our Norwegian friends have been concerned about all along, the EU's regulatory hegemony, how this model of you converge in exchange for access creates these huge asymmetries of power. Europe is this unilateral exporters of rules. Maybe that's okay to be a regulatory hegemon. Maybe that's the kind of biggest, best power we have. But our Norwegian friends were unhappy, but swallowed it because they could depoliticize it. With Brexit, we've learned that you can't, not with a country like Britain. And this will have an effect on the neighborhood. And this is where the operative word for Europe, the challenge is to organize symmetry. You know, we're talking a lot about symmetry because suddenly we have a symmetric shock and solidarity looks very differently because moral hazard looks very different. You know, maybe those who suffer the most are actually morally attractive because they keep their grandparents in their house and that's part of their problem. But the point is here that the great lesson of Brexit is that, you know, Europe needs to think about its externalization of rule in a more symmetric way. And I think it's an interesting twist on what you talked about, the big recovery fund, the mutualization, beginning of mutualization of debt. Well, that's kind of a new approach to symmetry. Instead of telling each other what to do with our budget, we're going to pool more resources, and we can come back to that. And the final point that I wanted to make here in this introduction, Guntram, is differentiation in a third way, as regime competition. You know, we're having a big discussion about democracies and autocracies, who does best in a COVID world within and outside Europe. And I think that in parallel to that, you know, that statecraft as stagecraft, what we're seeing is that our societies do better as theater of care than theaters of war. And here the operative word really is transparency. Because of course, the core cause of the pandemic is obscurity, you know, starting with opaque Chinese bureaucracy and other bureaucracies. And I think that the challenge for the convention is to really demonstrate by example that we can reinvent democracy, first of all, as transparency. And we can say a lot about global transparency, but in Europe today, and this is a question back to Gabby, but I'm sure John Eric has things to say about this. How do we create a convention, a process that both itself is transparent and really allows citizens to take over Europe, as one of this coalition of citizens calls itself these days? I can say more about that, but also, demonstrates how the EU in the long term can be a kind of different bubble, not a bubble closed onto itself, but a bubble because everybody can see through it and work with it, including, you know, if we take the great budget debates we're going to have in parallel to the convention, can we imagine participatory budgeting? All of these things are questions of transparency. And at the end of the day, what I'm trying to say, Guntram, is that if we think of all the multifacets of our differentiation, can we have a new philosophy, you know, of autonomy, symmetry, and transparency if we're reinventing Europe?
Thank you, Calypso. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and I want to come back to you perhaps in a few minutes. But before that, let me try to bring in John Eric. John Eric, you just heard Calypso saying, well, hegemony, is the EU a hegemon and regulatory hegemon? And I mean, how do you see this, perhaps this particular aspect, and how this would play also in this Future of Europe conference? I mean, should the Future of Europe conference foresee elements of differentiation, or should we accept that you know, the EU basically, once it decides on health policy, that health policy should basically apply to everyone, and even to countries that are not in the EU? I mean, just to give a sort of concrete example, I mean, how do you see this differentiation versus integration aspect?
On the differentiation, it is, we have to go back to the way in which sovereignty is configured in contemporary Europe, because what we see is that member states pool and share sovereignty in the EU institutions. And what is interesting with this is that that, of course, means that they are engaged in, and they have agreed to take on a number of different tasks jointly. At the same time, when the integration process proceeds, this still means that the framework that has been established at the European level has a significant effect on what states do domestically. So the idea of self-rule, this is what we experience in Norway. It is very difficult to make any kind of watertight compartment in relation to a dynamic entity that you signed on to with a, in a more limited sense. As long as the EU integrates, you will be more and more included in this anyway. So that's the center of gravity. Now, is the solution then to ask the EU to change itself to do this, or should it force a discussion inside of Norway or the other affiliated states to find ways of dealing with this where they can also participate, where decisions are being made? I'm sorry, but this one is, to me, fairly straightforward, actually, in the sense that for small states that are on the periphery of this, particularly when the stakes are so large, and this is where the conference and the whole debate on dealing with the pandemic come in, because it is about the future of the European political order. It's not only about the EU, but it is exactly what type of rules and norms and what kind of politics is going to be unfolding. And the European Union has also a possibility of being and saying something in relation to the rest of the world in terms of also enforcing a system of rule-bound behavior. And that's one of the things that is at stake. So this has a fairly, to some extent, a unifying element, but it also gives people predictability. Now, of course, that also means it needs to be democratically controlled. And what we see in the EU is that there is a significant expectations capacity gap. Is that people, the EU is now actually so involved in so many issues, and yet it doesn't have capacity beyond regulation. So it is orchestrating and coordinating state capacities, and therefore there's a lot of diversity in this. However, this does not add up to capacity also in an accountability sense, so people can see where decisions are made and where the buck stops. So it's instead being blended together in a pretty big mesh. And one of the key culprits in this is the European Council, that has shirked away from stating out what kind of system the European Union is supposed to be. This was the case with the European Convention in the early 2000s, and it was guiding the process, and it was preventing the development of a constitution by dividing the different provisions of the treaties and so on into a clear constitutional element. And it has since then also been developing the institutions so that you have a fairly lopsided union where core state powers are still very much within the remit of member states, but kind of coordinated by the EU. And then you have a single market that is fairly centralized, with the states also to some extent locked into this. So it's a lopsided kind of system. So this is also one element of differentiation, but it's a kind of bias that's built in. And what we saw with COVID was that the particular competences that were needed to deal with health issues were not there. And people obviously had expectations because the EU was regulating so many other aspects, and yet it didn't have, as Gabi was saying, anything on the health aspect. So there is a lopsided element in this. So the question is, can you then develop adequate capacity also to ensure that people's expectations in this are being met? Because how can you have mobility and so on if you also don't have a coordinated European health policy? and also a policy in terms of stabilizing the economic situations and so on. And that's that, in that sense, the Franco-German initiative is really interesting. But this is an initiative for the entire EU. It is not a differentiated initiative. It asks all the member states to sign on to this and to be part of it. So this is a de-differentiating initiative in some ways, a unifying element, and therefore to push integration. And this has to do with capacity building. Now, I think in terms of the conference, the catch here is that it is important to include citizens, of course. I mean, we're all Democrats, and that's fundamental. The question also is, under what conditions? And if you look at these, for instance, innovative proposals from the Parliament and the Commission about citizens, new hackathons and all kinds of things, that's very interesting. And they have had very positive experiments. But this also has to be sluiced into the general working of the political system. And if this is done, but without a clear commitment to having a treaty change, then there would be a lot of ambiguity and people to be able to manipulate that. So if you want to have a treaty change at the end, I think that should come out as a clear commitment. If it doesn't, one should look at the ambitions in relation to this. The other comment is, I think, the tension between reforming from strength versus reforming from weakness. It seems to me that the EU at current is very vulnerable, and it doesn't score high on output legitimacy in people's minds. And that to me seems to be a problem. So that actually so this has to do with the timing of the conference when it works. So if the EU actually manages to show that it can deal with the COVID pandemic in a more systemic way, and that people can see tangible benefits, then I think that can itself give momentum to the conference, and therefore also the push for further reforms. But if the EU starts now and hopes that reforms will be coming through consulting with citizens, this is a fairly high risk game if there isn't a clear commitment to a type of change. And again, I don't trust the European Council in this, because it has shirked away from staking out what the EU is supposed to be doing. And the Parliament has consistently been trying to do so.
Right. So thank you, John Eric. Of course, I'm sure, Gabi, you will be very pleased to hear the criticism of the European Council. Because that's a typical reaction in the European Parliament. But let me just perhaps push you on to react on a few points you just heard. I think one important point was, I think, really this expectation capacity gap. I think that's the way you called it, John Eric, which really means sort of we are so European and citizens are so much in the EU that they sort of assume the EU is in charge, right? And then in the end, it turns out it's not in charge, and everybody is very disappointed by that. So how do you solve this with the Future of Europe conference? And the other point that perhaps I want to push you on is really the transparency and the democracy issue. I mean, this whole Future of Europe conference concept looks very opaque to me still. I mean, it's... we had these conferences before. Then you never know what is it really a conference. I mean, a conference, there's all kinds of conferences all the time on Europe. So what is different now? And why is that a transparent way of really involving citizens? And why is it legitimate, actually? And how does it increase democratic legitimacy? I mean, we have parliaments that are in charge of democratic legitimacy. And if we want a new constitution, we should have a referendum, right? I mean, so I'm a little bit puzzled by this whole democracy transparency aspect and how this whole exercise is actually going to improve this. So perhaps you can react to those two points.
Yeah, first I would like to come back also to see, we had the experience in the last European elections that for the first time, we really had, again, a huge increase in participation, and the question of democracy played an essential part in it. And the fear that also the European Parliament could be paralyzed or blocked by nationalist and anti-European forces. And if you look at the idea and the concept as the Parliament developed it, and I addressed it in the beginning, it is not the expectation that the citizens have to push for treaty changes, But when you analyze on one hand the debates of the last years and the involvement of citizens, there was an increase, and it was also, as it was said by John Eric, an arena where a lot of experiments took place, how to better involve citizens, how to use digital means to do so. But the problem also very often is that only a small part of society takes part in this kind of debates. And it's mainly the already pro-European parts of society, and also very often with a high level of education, etc., etc. So this is also why we said we just don't want only more involvement of citizens, but that we want to have these agoras with randomly selected citizens that really reflect the society in Europe we have, in terms of not only gender and age, but also in terms of socioeconomic background or education, and to have a European dynamic. And I think this is the difference. We would have European citizens, so the Italian plumber will listen to the Dutch, maybe unemployed woman, and also listen to the different realities and develop something together. They will also experience that the situation is very different in the countries and perceived, and that we would make this this process also very transparent. And we now have new means how we can do it. If you look at the institutional panel in the concept of the parliament, these debates would be streamed, and everyone that is interested could listen to these debates in this institutional panel composed of parliamentarians, national and European, the governments, the commission. And I think transparency will be key, and with this also to raise a broader interest. Engage schools to participate in this event, watching debates, organizing their own events, civil society in a broad way. So this conference for 2 years, I agree with you that the title Conference on the Future of Europe was and still is a bit irritating, because with conference you associate something that lasts maybe 2 or 3 days maximum, but not for 2 years. But to have this process and in the end focus, but focusing it on results. And I think the difference is, if I digitally consult citizens in Europe, and you never know what happens with your comments, suggestions you did, or if you have feedback loops where citizens come up with a proposal they worked on, and the institutional panel has to deal with it. They also have to give a feedback what happened to the proposals. Do they land somewhere in the orbit, or are they really taken on board? And I think indeed one should not overestimate that you will expect a miracle, because the situation regarding treaty changes is very clear. There you have in the European Council, you have governments that are in favor of treaty changes, and you have some that don't, but also in the parliament, I think you have a majority, you have a clear vision also what to change, but there are also forces that don't are very happy about treaty changes.
But Gabi, can I push you on those? Because I'm also taking from the audience questions here, and Frederic Lauro asked the question, I mean, what is the point of having a conference on the future of Europe if from the start treaty changes are excluded? And Marco Cecchinelli asks, all goes back to the lack of a real European public debate. Political arenas are still national, and the information system gives them what they are used to. So is this conference really going to change anything, or is it just sort of a fig leaf for creating some sort of a European debate? And after that, Calypso, I want to come to you. But Gabi, if you can quickly react to those and give the EP view.
I think it's you have to differentiate with, this was never intended to be a formal Article 48 procedure. But for me, this is the prelude to a 48 procedure with this, if it's done well. And therefore, I still see the opportunity here that should be used. And on the other hand, this was our intention, not again to have limited national arenas for debates. And this citizens' agora are European agoras. And this will be very important in the negotiation between the three institutions to keep this aspect that we don't have, again, decoupled national debates instead of engaging in European debates and creating something like a European public space for debate.
So Calypso, perhaps you can also react to the fragmentation of the debate issue. I think that's a very, very interesting point, that and whether such a conference can actually help increase debates cross borders. And the other point I would like to push you on is a question here by Mr. Anonymous, or Mrs. Anonymous. Do you expect the European Court of Justice post-COVID-19 as helping reduce the dominance or bolstering bolstering democracy? Insisting on EU law supremacy seems bound to generate conflicts. I mean, should we go for less EU law supremacy, and should the European Court of Justice perhaps pull back a bit and be less insistent on the European law? Perhaps you can take those two, Calypso.
Absolutely, and Guntram, everything Gabby says is music to my ears, and I very much hope that her vision of the convention will dominate, will be what we get. I mean, I speak as someone who took part in the 2001-03 convention, where really the democratic aspect was very perfunctory, and there are indeed many lessons to learn, and I think we should stress that there's been a huge amount of scholarly work since then on what is participatory democracy, how does it work, how does it complement, because you were worried, Guntram, about parliaments, but they go together, and there's been all these experiments around Europe in participatory assemblies, etc., that Gabby was alluding to. But what we're seeing, but very often these agoras are very local, and it's not clear to citizens, as you were saying, you know, how it represents them. I think the COVID moment is where we are seeing how technology is helping us make these transnational, and including technologies of translation, as it were. And it suggests also that, you know, there is not bad direct democracy, that, yes, there are problems with plebiscite, but their direct voice across borders need to be about, you know, coordinated inputs, dialogues between different countries or locales that communicate with each other. This would, you know, transnational democracy. So can the convention be a forum for that and demultiply these conversations? And that's where I think we should put in the mix of our conversation, the media. Incipient European public space. We may be many demoi, but we create these conversations among us. You know, there is this wonderful summer of solidarity that is happening just as we speak, and where I think that a lot of participants are trying to do exactly that. So let's remember the kind of ideal of experimentation. Now, that's for the process, your process question, Guntram, but you're also asking a substance question, you know, what, at the end of the day, what's our vision of Europe? And when we say expectation capacity gap, I think we need to remember, this is the supremacy question, that the EU is there to increase the capacity of all of the actors within it, states, regions, cities, individuals. It's an empowering mechanism. And sometimes that means centralizing, sometimes not. This is why a bigger budget, you know, is not about doing more at the European level on everything, but it's really about distributed intelligence, empowering different bits of Europe to act. And so how the European Court of Justice comes into that, we're not going to rewrite European law. There is something called supremacy. The question is how we interpret it, that it is about maybe supremacy in one area, but it doesn't mean that, for instance, in all of health, suddenly Europe will be supreme. So I think the German court, you know, is very much telling us and giving a challenge to the European Court of Justice to say, you know, how is it that we organize our European law as a way of really creating mutual interest, mutual regardingness, other regardingness, as we like to say, in Europe. That's what European law should be about. And including sometimes sunset clause and all sorts of ways in which citizens who may be worried about, who are on the other side, you know, Gabby was saying that all these activists are more pro-European, but really we need to bring everybody back in on the conversation of this kind of empowerment vision of Europe.
So John Eric, let me also bring you in. I mean, of course, there's many points you might want to react to quickly, but let me throw one question to you, which I get from the audience also, which I think is a very pertinent question by Sophia. She asks whether the panel, whether you envisage increased accountability over EU spending in the future, especially now that we spend an extra 700 billion via Next Generation EU. I mean, do we have enough accountability and don't we need more?
Well, it's not a straightforward issue like this, but it has to do with how the institutions are configured. I think the EU, generally speaking, is quite accountable in terms of financing. There's quite a strict set of mechanisms for this, and I don't think the EU is the biggest problem. Now, the question rather is one, in my mind at least, is one of whether you have democratic accountability, and that has to do with the relations among the institutions and to what extent Parliament and the popularly elected are able to have a significant say in the generation and the allocation of funding. And let me just add and bring this in relation to Calypso's points, because one has to be very careful about the distinction between centralization and federalization. And this is also, I think Calypso and I are completely on the same page on this, that the fact all issues cannot be dealt with at the European level at a kind of centralization. Rather, it is an important thing to devise a clear alliance that say something about who does what. Now, the catch in the European Union is that so much is now blended together, and therefore it is quite difficult. So that has also to do with the broader accountability, is that member states are so interwoven with the European Union institutions. It would be better for the European institutions to be somewhat more independent, but also with a lower or more limited remit. And therefore, but that means that you have a higher visibility and therefore a clearer sense of what the EU is supposed to be doing and what not doing. And that also comes over to the court. Again, since there is no overarching script for what the EU is that people have agreed on, each institution is kind of hardwired to push, and the European Court of Justice has the obligation to protect and develop European law. And it does so, but not with the same kind of institutional controls that you would have in a normal state that had a more clearly established constitution with divisions of competence. So what we get a bit of an irony is that you have over-centralization without this type of accountability, because there is not a script that people have agreed to. So this, it seems to me, a kind of a federal irony in this sense. The other thing I wanted to mention for the conference is one dimension that I think is that it seems that one is relying a lot on participatory democracy to strengthen representative democracy because of the role of the parliament. Now, one dimension that was in the previous convention and also in this conference is national parliaments. So actually we have the possibility of activating the parliamentary dimension in Europe in general, and that relating to citizens, that can be dynamite. So, I mean, it's not only the European Parliament, but it's actually the parliamentary dimension, that is the interaction among parliaments in terms of representative democracy, and that make that work together with participatory democracy.
I was wondering if your questioner on accountability had in mind, for instance, the fact that right after COVID, we've had this rapid reaction on budget, giving money under structural funds all over Europe to deal with the pandemic. But the problem was that some countries, and I won't name them, and in fact, many countries were not accountable, say a city or a government, about how they spend EU money. And so part of the role of the EU, and hopefully to be strengthened by the convention or the conference, is to be an arbiter or an intervener, not to tell local authorities what to do, but to force them to be accountable to their own citizens when they spend EU money. And that in turn, you know, means also being accountable, you know, vertically. But the important thing is, as always, for Europe to strengthen local democracy and therefore local accountability.
Gabi, can I get your reaction really on this? Because I think this point really on the money point, it's always getting interesting when we talk about money, especially when you're an economist. And so I mean, let me perhaps give my 5 cents. I mean, I think it's absolutely fundamental that we do this EU recovery package. I think it's a welcome, from an economic point of view, an absolutely welcome response that the EU goes out there, borrows money, and thereby helps to smooth the shock and helps countries to cope with this massive shock. So as an economist, I'm 100% in favor of this. Now then, I guess my question as a citizen is, we've seen EU money being wasted before. We've seen EU money not being properly accounted for. We've seen, and there's been nice reporting in the New York Times about this, for example, money really going to fund oligarchs, money going to fund big farmers, landowners that are connected with the political system. So we are seeing actually in some areas a lack of proper accountability. And in some cases, Calypso, it's even the case that the national political system and the national democracies are perfectly fine because they still vote with overwhelming majority for the person that uses the money in a way that we might not enjoy and we might not like. So really, what is the kind of accountability we need when we spend so much money, much more money? And don't we need at some stage really treaty change so that the parliament really is empowered and has the taxation power and really goes in that direction?
Absolutely. I mean, on one hand, I also see the recovery package as a big progress in terms of, and it seems to be even to create a sort of federalist moment. But on the other hand, I'm very, very worried. If I look at the different funds and I look, for example, on this new one, the resilience fund that will be spent and connected to the European semester, that has almost the same size as all structural funds together. And this will be done just on sort of technocratic level between, on one hand, the Commission and the member states in exchange money, in exchange for reforms, without any role of the European Parliament and any democratic accountability. And I think this is something that should not happen. And I think here we need really big changes, and we really need a role of the European Parliament and national parliaments in this European semester, because otherwise we are even losing out democratic accountability instead of what we discuss, how can we increase it? And so to see this moment and to address it, and I can see in we are discussing it at the moment in the parliament, in many parties, a lot of concern and also a lot of willingness to address it and to change it. And I think this should be something, especially if I look at the economic governance, how to increase democratic accountability here. And I mean, these are reforms, as Bruegel was very active there. We have all these reports. We know what needs to be changed, and we don't need to start this debate again. But we need the political will also to do it. And otherwise, I fear that Europe will be losing out very much with the citizens, because this question of who is responsible for what decision that affects my life is essential for citizens.
So in the end, we need treaty change. I think we almost seem to converge on this. But there's a question, Calypso, which I think I want to throw at you from a person called Donald from Antwerp. He's saying, do you truly believe that the Italian plumber is waiting for an agora and in-depth discussion on the future of Europe? It all sounds nice, but will it work? That's a very practical question. But please, since you talked about the agora and the debates cross borders, can you say a few words on this?
Yes, we looked at the examples we have on national level with this kind of agoras, and it works. I mean, you can involve the different people, but you need to invest in it. If you really want it, you don't get this for free. It's not like you announce an internet debate and then people join. But if there is the willingness, yes, I'm convinced it can work. And I mean, for me, with the future of Europe, it's the same with COVID. We are at a point at the moment where we have to decide, do we go back to the old normal, or do we embark and use this opportunity on something new, as you say, reinvent the European Union, but go on a new path? And this governance and the structure of the future of Europe will be a bit of a step in the direction that we don't want to do business as usual and just continue like this, but that we want to try out new path to be able to rebalance Europe again.
Calypso, do you want to say a few more words about the agoras, but perhaps also about
the Italian plumber?
Perhaps another question, I mean, that relates here by a person called Eric Paul. He says, COVID-19 suddenly changed the way we work, the way we learn, the way we cure, the way we legislate. And it pushed us into the 21st century. Don't you think victims deserve Europe to be bold, and bolder than just a conference that doesn't come to a strong result and only to report?
I mean, yes, and in a way this relates to our Italian plumber, because I was remembering the Polish plumber, and maybe our pressure did too. And these are two different plumbers, right? The Italian plumber, I think in our questioner's view, is the guy who stays, or the women, after all, they're women plumbers, versus the Polish plumber who was a nomad of Europe. And part of what we're remembering today is that Europe, yeah, there is wonderful free movement and all that, but Europe should serve those who stay, those who do their own thing and don't really travel all around. And so the Italian plumber, you know, has at least three identities. You know, one is he's just a citizen, and he wants to do his job. He needs good infrastructures and all the rest of it. And he's really happy, I guess, sometimes to see the European budget help Italy have the kind of infrastructure that helps him do his job. And this is where everything Gabby said and you said, Guntram, about, you know, he might listen to the radio and see that maybe we're going to be much more transparent about where this money goes. He's also a taxpayer, right? And this is where I would go one step further than Gabby and say, hey, why don't we do real, like Brazil, your other places, real participatory budgeting? They're fantastic experiments that involve, yes, parliaments, but also other ways, cities, city councils, etc. And the Italian plumber as a taxpayer would love this. But secondly, the Italian plumber, you know, has children, looks to the next generation. And that's where I think we can spend European money more transparently if we have real benchmarks. If it's clear why we're spending this money, and coming out of the COVID crisis as a green power, we haven't talked enough about this, but this is what our kids really, really care about. And I think the Italian plumber will too. And finally, the Italian plumber, thirdly, is also a dreamer, also has a vision of the world. And this is where this other question about let's be bold, you know, maybe that's the exact point, is that they're at home and everywhere else, can we engineer simply a democratic conversation about what Europe can do for the world? And I think at the end of the day, that also will inspire, you know, and in COVID, where we see, you know, the problem of Africa and all the developing countries, this is going to be even greater. And I think our Italians, French, Latvian, and Greek plumbers will all very much watch that too, including because that will have a direct impact on migration wave. And they understand that, because citizens are super clever. Let's never forget the wisdom of the multitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. John Eric, you will have, I think, the last word. Time is coming to an end. But indeed, we didn't have time to talk much about the climate issues and the role Europe should play on climate. We talked about health, we talked about the budget, the recovery on the content side, not on the on the legitimacy side and accountability, but on the content side. One further area of action where I think a lot of citizens really expect the EU and Europe to deliver, and where perhaps the competences are also not sufficient, is climate policy and health policy. Climate policy, because good climate policy ultimately needs taxation, carbon taxation, and taxation is a national competence. We have an emission trading system, but that emission trading system only covers 50% of our emissions. The rest is not covered by any EU mechanism. It's covered by national mechanisms, so we are not going far enough on this issue. And we might actually need more EU action. And the citizens, certainly when in surveys, they often say, well, I mean, climate policy is really one of those things where, you know, ultimately it's not my nation state that's going to solve climate change. It's really the EU that should be our actor here. But okay, I mean, this is another big debate we can have, but and I'm sure it will be part of these conferences of Europe debates. But John Eric, perhaps you can give us a few concluding words, and then we have to close, I'm afraid, because our 1 hour is over, and it's been a fascinating discussion. John Eric.
Thanks. Well, one of the interesting aspects of COVID, of course, is that experts, especially on health policy and so on, have been significant in many states, and politicians at variable degrees have listened to them. I think you can look at the extent to which governments have abided by the expertise in this. Of course, experts are not democratically accountable, but they're accountable to the knowledge and expertise. And democracy also needs this type of expertise and knowledge. And we can see significant differences between states where leaders have abided by some of this knowledge and tried to exchange this across borders and so on to develop the best possible policies on the basis of knowledge. A similar argument comes in, of course, on the environment or sustainability and the green policy, that the expertise, and the EU has developed a tremendous expertise on this and has staked out a course and has also tried to show how this can manifest itself in concrete actions. So the broader understanding here is on, and of course, what it means is that the political conversation is different. The, I would say, manipulative so-called populists who were unconcerned with truth have been found out to a large extent. And I'm hoping that this is something that can continue. The problem here is that what is called populist is actually a very much a spiteful notion of what populism really was, because it was democratic and it had to do with listening to people and getting in touch with people. And that's, of course, we see elements of this now also in what the institutions are doing, and we should not underplay this, because this interaction is important. Now, what the European Union is trying to do is also to bring in the expertise element in it, and all the citizens' assemblies and so on have had a healthy exchange between this type of expertise and popular discussions and so on, and have shown the necessary building and that people develop views and reflect on their own stances and so on when they are confronted with these types of expertise. So this is an important element to try to harness. Right. Thank you.
Indeed, the role of experts is yet another dimension of all of this, but thank you. I think this is really a very, very important debate that is starting, and I think we will all watch very closely what will come out of the various approaches to the Conference of Europe and what in the end will be the process and what will be then also the substance of this. And I think we will really listen very attentively, and perhaps even one of us will be as a citizen or as an expert somehow get involved. Gabriele Bischoff, thank you so much for joining us today. Calypso Nicolaides, thank you so much for joining us. And John Eric Fossum, you are a co-organizer, but thank you still for joining us. This was a great debate, and thank you to our listeners for asking the questions. And please go on our website www.bruegel.org to read about many of the topics we are discussing here, or on the website of EU3D, where we discuss accountability, democracy, and legitimacy in a differentiated Europe. Thank you so much to all of you, and until next time, bye-bye.